Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this public lecture, which is a really exceptional opportunity to hear the work of one of a major environmental political campaigners of the moment, Margaret Wallström. Margaret Wallström is well known as she's the EU Environment Commissioner. She has been holding that post since September 1999, has been extremely active in promoting the environmental protection in that period. But she's also, I know, very interested in looking at the positive interrelationships between economic activities and environmental protection. And I think that is going to be one of the key themes that she's going to talk about this afternoon. She's also had a long career in politics before that, in the Swedish Parliament and in government. She was Minister for Consumer Affairs, Women and Youth, Minister for Culture, Minister for Social Affairs as well. So she has a background more broadly than in just in the environmental area. And before that, she also worked, which I don't think everybody knows, but she worked in the media as a CEO of various media companies. We're very much looking forward to her talk this evening, so I ask you to welcome Margaret Wallström.
Thank you very much. I am happy and honored to have the opportunity to address such an important crowd of VIPs, because very important persons you are. Tomorrow's, and I see also today's, policymakers, journalists, economists, business women, and what have you. You are heartily welcome, and thank you for coming to listen to me. I have thought long and hard about my main messages to you this afternoon, and this is what I came up with. Some good news and some bad news. A position between doomsday and Hakuna Matata, you know, no worries. A banana in plastic. A car made out of soybeans, and a signal of hope for a sustainable development and a toolbox. So bear with me, and I'll try to take you on a journey through the consumer society we live in. And you've probably already heard that story about the good news and the bad news, the patient going to the doctor and the doctor says, I have some good news and I have some bad news. And the patient says, well, give me the bad news first, please, doctor. And the doctor says, well, you have a terrible, incurable disease which will leave you crippled and in great pain for the rest of your life. And the patient says, well, what can be good news? Well, you only have a week to live. The bad news that I bring is that we are, in fact, consuming our world and its future. Read the World Watch Institute's Earth Report from this year, 2004. Private consumption expenditure has increased fourfold since 1960 and had reached more than 17 trillion euros in 2000. Today, 50% of our global consumer class live in developing countries. Around 1.7 billion people worldwide, more than a quarter of humanity, have entered the consumer class and now have diets, transportation systems, and lifestyles that for most of the last century were known only in the rich nations of Europe, North America, and Japan. Now, we should nonetheless remember that consumers still have quite different ecological footprints. The imbalance is in fact staggering. Of the world's population, the 12% living in North America and Western Europe account for 60% of total consumption, while the 33% living in South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa account for only 3.2%. What does this growing consumer class mean? More global prosperity, a fairer society, and sustainable development. Well, if we use the three dimensions of sustainable development as a yardstick, the economic, the social, and environmental criteria, we have to admit that the picture is rather mixed, and that in many cases, the evidence speaks for itself. From an environmental perspective, despite enormous technological progress, the impacts of our consumption in terms of abuse or inefficient use of natural resources is enormous. Here again, just a few telling examples, in particular in the area of waste. Every year, Americans throw away some 20 billion disposable nappies, making them the third largest source of solid waste in the nation's landfills. And with today's manufacturing standards, most of them will take actually centuries to decompose. Every month, we throw away 45 tons of obsolete CDs, Eminem and Kim. On average, we keep a mobile phone for 18 months, and there are estimates that show that by 2005, consumers have stockpiled 500 million cell phones that are likely to end up in landfills where they could leach as much as 142 tons of lead. And now it's time to check the technology here. I think this is really an interesting illustration of waste. And maybe the stupidity. It's not easy to see, but this is a banana. That is easy to see. And it is packaged in a plastic bag. And I think this was actually bought in the UK in a petrol station where they sold this one. So this fantastic natural package surrounding a banana has been put in a plastic cover, ending up also in landfills, I suppose. I think this is maybe an example of stupidity as well, human stupidity. Our ecosystems are shrinking to make way for the rapid growth of the consumer economy. Industrial fleets have now fished out at least 90% of the large ocean fish. Groundwater levels are decreasing at worrying rates in developing countries, and about half of the world's original forest cover is now gone. Not to speak about fossil fuels and global warming and what that will do to our planet in the near future. Let's look at China. China's GDP is projected to quadruple by 2020. Estimates show that there will be over 150 million cars in China by 2015, as many as there were in the US in 1999. And in the next 3 years alone, China's steel, chemical, construction materials, and mobile phone industries could double their production capacities. This is causing, of course, increasing demand for energy, chiefly oil, to grow rapidly. And China is on the fast track to become the world's second largest oil consumer behind the US. And this development will also put additional pressure on the environment and the climate and the Kyoto objectives. Now, I want to make absolutely clear that I'm not saying that consumption growth in itself is bad. Of course, we need consumption. We need consumptions to live, to create jobs, to meet basic needs, and to improve quality of life. And the world's poorest people, like those in sub-Saharan Africa, where consumption is actually decreasing, will need to consume more if they are like us, are to lead lives of dignity and opportunity. So I'm not questioning the fact that we belong to the consumer class. I'm rather questioning how we consume and what kind of growth we are promoting. Globalization has certainly helped to reduce some of the world's poverty, but the picture which is emerging shows us a world with increasing extremes of wealth and poverty. We see a dangerous polarization between the people living in developed and developing countries, or rather, between the growing global class of consumers and those who do not belong to that class. 2 out of 5 humans on this planet live on less than €2 a day, and roughly 1.2 billion people live in extreme poverty, with an average income of less than €1 a day. What is that in pounds? Well, you can count. There are also huge problems with access to clean water and sanitation, energy and education. And we continue to see conflict-driven humanitarian disasters, as in Sudan, where in the best-case scenario, 100,000 people are expected to die in the coming months due to targeted destruction of water sites and food stores. And last but not least, gender inequality between men and women is one of the world's biggest instances of injustice when it comes to resource distribution. In short, we are not delivering on the United Nations Millennium Goals. And of course, it comes clear when discussing in the UN just recently, the other week when I was there, on the water target, where we've decided in Johannesburg to cut by half the number of people who do not have access to clean drinking water and access to basic sanitation. Could you imagine sending your child to school with 700 pupils with not a toilet? Could you imagine going 4 times a day, 7 kilometers one way to fetch that 20 liters of water that you need daily to be able to survive, using so much time on that, as a 10-year-old would do in Ghana? And my 10-year-old, he would shower 200 liters of water per day. These are the inequalities. And in most cases, it's the young girls who have to do the work, or the women. So these are the inequalities that still exist. It is clear that in order to cope with population growth and rising living standards in developing countries, we need to substantially reduce the materials use generated by current production and consumption models. There is no other way to accommodate the twin imperatives of environmental protection and social equity. There is no way we can stop global warming and create a sustainable society without addressing consumption or our fossil fuel-based economic system on a global scale. Well, it's time for some good news, don't you think so? In the USA, during the Great Depression in the 30s, there was a man, an inventor, who spent long hours in his lab near Detroit trying to turn soybeans into cheap plastic. This man was already known for wearing suits and ties made out of soybeans, but his big dream was to produce a car with a plastic body made completely of soybeans. It goes without saying that, of course, most people thought that he was absolutely bonkers. Little did he care because in 1941, he unveiled a handmade soybean car, and his name was Henry Ford, one of the world's greatest inventors. But there was just one little snag in this story, a story that could have changed our fate considerably. Like many investors who have tried to commercialize bio-based materials, Ford never managed to produce marketable soybean-based plastics because his plastics could not compete price-wise with petroleum-based plastics, which is still the dominating industrial polymer. So what became of Henry Ford's dream? More than 60 years have elapsed since then, and the USA is now a country with a president that is rather known for, I would say, rejecting global environmental governance. But actually, there is a kind of grassroots revolution going on in the States over climate change and sustainable development, which we can observe if we move just a little bit away from Washington. Several states, by now led by California, Massachusetts, and New York, have joined the eastern provinces of Canada in vowing to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 12% before the end of the decade, independent of federal policy. A dozen states and cities have even sued the Environmental Protection Agency for refusing to treat CO2 as a pollutant. And since 1990, California has been working on implementing policies that could push the market to develop so-called PZEVs, partial zero emission vehicles, hybrid cars with a 90% emission reduction, and ZEVs, that is zero emission vehicles, electric or fuel cell driven vehicles with emission cuts of 99%. All this has been possible because of a virtuous interplay between the political world on the one hand and civil society, organized NGOs, and progressive industrialists on the other hand. And what we see here is a case of progressive actors working on the basis of a new economic rationality, which promotes all three dimensions of sustainable development. By thinking ahead, or backcasting, as it's sometimes called, you look into the future, imagine and try to envisage what will happen in the future, and then you try to move to today to start those things happening. These actors have realized that we are facing the end of the oil economy and that sustainable development is cost efficient. So perhaps we have the chance of seeing Henry Ford's dream come true and also seeing the light in the end of the tunnel, and let's hope it's not a train. Now, this is the next picture. I never use this overhead pictures or slides, but maybe it works. I think that was when I meant to speak about this car. The first impression of this car is, of course, another of these super trendy and fuel-consuming monsters that cause congestion and pollution in the streets of our cities. Actually, it is Grandma disguised in wolf's clothing. Last year at the Detroit Motor Show, the Ford Motor Company, in homage to its founder, presented a car concept known as Model U Green Car. It's the ultimate recyclable car. You can eat it, eliminate it, and use it as a fertilizer to grow it all over again. It has a corn-based canvas sunroof. The interior is made of recyclable polyester, the carpets of maize, and the seed cushions of soybeans. The engine oil comes from sunflower seeds. And to top it all, the car is powered by a supercharged hydrogen fuel combustion engine. This engine has near to zero emissions and has cut carbon dioxide emissions by 99%. And what we are looking at is the end of oil age and the old combustion engine. And Ford would, of course, be rejoicing today. Biotechnological innovations have managed to solve the puzzle he was wrestling with. Plant-based plastics can easily compete price-wise with petroleum-based plastics. It is important to see what is going on in the USA, in the land of consumerism par excellence, and of course also by far the biggest polluter in the world. It is clear that China is aggressively seeking to curb the pollution that goes hand in hand with rapidly growing energy demands as well. A renewable energy promotion law is in the pipeline, due at the end of this year. And at the recent international symposium on China's strategy for developing hydrogen-powered cars held in Shanghai, it became clear that China has for a long time started to develop fuel cell cars and the use of hydrogen energy. And hydrogen is definitely an official and vital part of China's energy strategy. Government officials say that developing renewable energy sources and hydrogen-driven cars are extremely urgent matters to China. It's an absolute necessity in order to safeguard energy security, economic progress, human health, and the environment. And there are many progressive initiatives that have been taken recently, like also the startup of sustainable villages and communities. Perhaps the greatest challenge will be for the developing countries to build strategies for leapfrogging to an eco-efficient economy. It's our duty, both for ethical reasons and for our self-interest, our very survival, to give them all the help we can. For obvious reasons, we must start with ourselves. The American and European consumer class is key to reshaping the relationship between consumption and sustainability, not only because we use most of the resources, but also because our consumption patterns echo around the world. And if environmental and equity reasons are not enough to persuade people to act, there are other reasons and persuasive arguments why we must change direction. we must understand that the world's economy is based on an energy source that is limited and will run out possibly sooner than we think. In addition, we are taking a high security risk in being so dependent on one energy source. This makes our society and economy highly fragile, including from the point of view of security and political stability. I do not believe in fate. I believe we can shape our future, and we must not let current trends become our destiny. I'm convinced that we can still manage to bridge the gap between a growing population, rising living standards, and the physical limitations of the planet. And I believe that innovation and technology, like the hydrogen combustion engine and fuel cells, U-turn technologies, are the key to spurring sustainable and equitable economic growth. A wide range of eco-efficient technologies already exist. U-turn technologies that could virtually address most of the resource and environmental problems we are now facing. So where do we stand in the European Union when it comes to sustainable development? Well, since Rio 1992, sustainable development has become a guiding principle in international law and in European policy making. And over the last decade, there has been a considerable effort within the EU institutions to make sustainable development a reality. Over time, increasing emphasis has been put on policy consistency, integrated approaches, impact assessment, and stakeholder involvement in policy making. Moreover, commitments undertaken at international level have helped to give shape to an external dimension, as it is called, of the EU strategy for sustainable development. Does this mean that we are on a steady path towards sustainability? Well, after 5 years as an environment commissioner, I can say without hesitation that we certainly are the world champions in terms of governance and multilateralism. But to be sincere and apply some self-criticism, it's clear that all our efforts have not succeeded in creating strong enough incentives to really change our production and consumption patterns. Unfortunately, too many of our economic and political players have not yet grasped that it is cost efficient to be sustainable, whether we're talking about natural, human, or societal resources. In other words, adopting a sustainable economic approach will also produce profitable businesses. I'm convinced that we can only revitalize Europe's economy by building on higher social and environmental standards, not the opposite. But this is far from being a widespread perception, as the debate on the chemicals reform has clearly demonstrated. And I know, of course, on a very practical level that by now I have 28 out of 77 different chemicals running around in my blood or being stored in my body. And I just think that we ought to consider whether we think that this is sustainable to continue to produce and accumulate in nature or in our bodies all of these highly toxic or cancerogenic or mutagenic or other substances that actually affect our reproductive capacity. Is this something we want, or can we change, and do we want to change course? Thinking ahead is not common practice in our business world and in many political circles. And I hope this is not another symptom of our aging society. It would be rather worrying. As somebody has put it, of all the rubbish we have accumulated around us, worn out ideas are the most dangerous. They live on in boardrooms, in political committee rooms, in organizations established in the backyard of an industrial society, eager to abdicate all responsibility, and in the lethargy and tendency of many individuals to bury their heads in the sand. A reason for this backward-looking attitude, which seems to be held by, unfortunately, many economic actors in Europe, is that European NGOs and civil society have not been very structured and strategic in creating economic demands for sustainable development. And the advances now being made in California show us that sustainable development cannot happen without strong demand in civil society. There are some interesting developments in Europe at the European level too. Just recently, several NGOs and civil society launched a European campaign for sustainable development. And it has a strategic focus on measures that are aimed at promoting sustainable investment in goods, services, housing, and transport. It's obvious that we also need to work with more modern tools and new concepts. We need policies that provide incentives and also reward sustainable behavior. We need policies that reward forerunners instead of the laggards, as our present system often does. In short, we must create conditions that support sustainable development. It implies a model of governance that involves not just governments, but also corporations and individuals, and this to a much broader and greater extent than before. So we must focus on policy measures and tools that foster a virtuous interplay between civil society, technology, the market, and legislation. And this is the toolbox, or parts of the toolbox that you can start to use. I do not want to explain all these instruments. It's just a list of it, what we can use. These are powerful, systematic tools, mostly of an economic nature, that can create strong incentives both for consumers and corporations to produce and consume differently. Let's take public procurement as one example. Public procurement in the European Union amounts to 1,300 billion euros a year. It is not difficult to see what impact of well-designed rules for public procurements could be, and they could help achieve a major shift towards sustainable technologies. Or look at subsidies. Recent estimates suggest that subsidies with distorting and detrimental impacts on the environment amount to 720 billion euros a year, with an additional 1 trillion euros worth of quantifiable environmental externalities or external environmental impact. Or take Dow Jones Sustainability Index for sustainability-driven investments, and that accounts now for a total market capitalization of over 4 trillion euros. This is an emerging market, and in Europe we have hardly begun to explore it. So these tools can create a new forward-looking economic rationality and make it work for sustainable development. We have the knowledge we need to bring about real change in terms both of technology and policy making. This would not be enough without a demand for change in society. If we want the vision of a sustainable Europe to become a reality, it will not be enough to work with the economy or technology on repealing legislation. So we could start more and more to balance consumption demand with quality of life. Reorienting society's priorities toward the good forms of consumption could act as a more reliable driving force for the economy, but also as a tool that delivers an improved quality of life, fairness, and human dignity. The world around us is inescapably international. Issues from business to agriculture, from human rights to relief of famine and gender equality, require us to use our imaginations to venture beyond narrow group loyalties and also consider the reality of distant lives and the impact of our living standards. And the added value of the concept of sustainable development is that it brings the future and the rest of the world into the picture. Now, just to offer you a challenge also, next time you're in front of your computer, go to the World Watch Institute's homepage and download a copy of their publication, Good Stuff. This is an excellent, interesting, and easy-to-use toolbox for consumers. I mean, this is more for policymakers and economic actors, but it's a guide also to sustainable shopping and consumption. Maybe it will inspire some simple changes, switching off the TV, the video, and the satellite receiver instead of leaving them on standby when you go to bed. If all Europeans would do that, we would reduce our CO2 emissions by 6.3 million tons a year. Now, I have already spoken perhaps too long. I will conclude my presentation, I borrow the prologue to a book by Paul Harrison. He begins his book, The Third Revolution, with a description of the plot in Hamlet. Claudius is swift in the commission of evil. There is no chink of delay between thought and deed, but Hamlet. Hamlet knows from the outset that something is wrong. By the end of Act I, he knows exactly what is wrong. At the end of Act II, he knows what needs doing. Act III brings his best chance of killing Claudius with least damage. He lets it pass. Then Polonius, Rosencrantz, Guildenstern, Ophelia, Laertes, and Gertrude all die unnecessarily. Hamlet waits until circumstances force his hand before he does what had to be done all along. Hamlet has less than half an hour to live. Hamlet's indecision is only too understandable. Translated to the environment, it means we're swayed both by those who say this situation is hopeless and nothing can be done about it, and those who say things are just fine and there's no need to get excited. Hamlet's indecision and vacillation and the devastating consequences are a perfect illustration of our own predicament, but like Paul Harrison, I think we're still somewhere near the beginning of the play. So, ladies and gentlemen, sustainable development is an idea whose time has come. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much indeed. The Commissioner has kindly agreed to take some questions, and there are some roving mics, I hope.
Stewards, yes.
So if we could have some hands up, could we take a mic to front here? And second here.
Thank you very much. I certainly agree that improvements in technology and efficiency are necessary. Do you think that they will be sufficient in the face of rising world consumption and a population that's going to grow by 3 billion in the next 40 years? Thank you.
We need a change, of course, in energy system and I think that in transport system, so you need a combination of policies that introduce also emission limits and introduce this whole new way of thinking and organizing society. Without investments in new energy systems, for example, this will not be possible. But you need all these elements to be able to move in the right direction. It is not a technological fix that will be easy. But we need that vision of where it is possible to go, and we need to change also these societal systems at the same time as we also create more of an awareness of, for example, the consumerism, and that it doesn't always bring a good quality of life to just consume. So it's a combination of all these elements. But technology will play a very important role.
Yes, my name is Camilla Toulmin. I'm the director of the International Institute for Environment and Development. We're in fact doing some work with your colleagues in the environment DG on the external dimensions of the EU's sustainable development strategy. I was really delighted to hear so strong a vision of the need to link up environment with a whole range of other factors, and also to see this strong emphasis on inequalities in access, consumption and incomes at global level. And I wondered if you could tell us something about the possible battles that you have within the Commission to see the extent to which you can start to get greater policy coherence across different areas of Commission activity in terms of trade, agriculture, transport, energy and those sorts of things, and the extent to which you've got real interest amongst your fellow commissioners in seeing how you can all point in the same direction. I wondered if you could also tell us how you see the political balance of the EU changing with the accession of 10 new states, particularly as it relates to this global commitment to trying to achieve a sustainable and fairer society.
How much time do I have to go enter into the internal discussions we have in the Commission? Well, I mean, this is also highly politically sensitive and controversial issues in the end. And of course, as soon as you enter into issues that member states would like to keep close to their chest and decide upon, and when you touch upon subsidiarity or you actually move into areas of conflict of interest, like with chemicals industry, where it's so clear that the business community has one view and those who speak in favor of improving the level of protection for human health and the environment stands on the other side. Of course, it is never easy, and all these political conflicts will also be much more visible, and there is a constant fighting. We have full respect of each other's different responsibility and so on, but of course this is a constant struggle to make room for the environment. And I think what we see now, and as a result of this economic downturn, we see the temptation to return to old solutions, look back and go back to the, as I say, the well-trodden paths of economic policy only. And now suddenly everything we propose from the environmental side has become a cost, a burden, a problem, a challenge, and something that is too expensive. So I think that this is almost an instinct, because this has also been the role of the European Union for so long that it was concentrated on economic policies and not so much else. And now you lose out, because in the end, who will provide growth and competitiveness? People will. And they will never be able to do it without access to water, natural resources, minerals, or clean air, or what have you. So, of course, it comes together must come together in a more holistic approach. But the truth, unfortunately, is that the fighting is sort of, and understand fighting right, but these conflicts are definitely visible, and we will continue along those lines and to fight for the place of the environmental policy in the European Union. What will happen with enlargement? I think most important is, I'm not so worried about the level of ambition being lowered when we now are 25 instead. I actually think that also in the new member states, civil society is starting to ask for environmental protection. They see clearly the benefits it brings to clean up the waters. They know that they cannot exercise environmental dumping. They know that their products and their production will also have to be done and carried out in the same way as in the rest of Europe and according to the same legislation. But of course, it all has to do with whether we can be effective, if we can actually take decisions, if we are able to have a good and efficient system. And that's where the IGC comes in, and why that is so important, to have a new constitutional treaty. And what is in the treaty is always what we can refer back to. It's important what is written in the European treaties on environment, for example, because that is what we can use as the leverage, and that is the hook for us. So that's why this debate is so important right now, to understand what is behind.
We have two at the front, behind and then at the very front.
Sorry, I'm Crispin Tickell. I ran the British government panel on sustainable development for 6 years. And at the end of the 6 years, the most important thing that emerged was the need to think differently about economics. I perhaps shouldn't say this in the London School of Economics, but one thing that became very clear to us was that a great many things were wrong about the intellectual methodology. And I think that should be coming into your toolbox. Mm. The fact that you shouldn't rely excessively on GNP, that you should redefine growth, and as the Chinese Prime Minister has said to me, what we need is not old-style economic growth, what we need is green, clean growth. Yeah. And I know that he's been saying this recently, and I think he probably said it when he was in London this week. I just like to think, and I'd like to hear your comments, that the Commission is now taking on board a real re-look at basic economics, because when you start getting your costing right, then a lot of the other things will come right too.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think that you were really focusing on this most difficult issue.
Mm. I would have liked to present sort of the full toolbox, or rather the toolboxes that we are trying to identify also for business, for the academic world, for individual consumers. I mean, you need toolboxes for all of these different areas and actors in society. So I agree 100%. And what about all these economists that do not know anything about sustainable development? I mean, of course, this is, I'm not saying, of course, you know here, but I think that this is really something that the academic world also has to look into and make sure that they organize work so that we start a completely new way of thinking. And look at the way they argue today. I mean, those who say that we should really concentrate on competitiveness and growth, which is fine, of course we should, but I mean, it's the content and how that is the important issues to us. And they always use the ultimate threat is that companies will move to China, not realizing that maybe also in China things are moving. They don't want our old stuff, polluting stuff. They also want to go for what belongs to the future and the future solutions. And this is maybe the sad thing about the debate on chemicals, that so few of these actors have actually been able to look more into the future. That is so much of short-term thinking, which I think also from an economic point of view is no good. So I can just agree with you, sir.
Thank you, Chairwoman. Professor, you wanted to put the Welsh name. Commissioner Margaret, despite having a stormy name, your lectures are as gentle as breeze. It's the second time I'm attending. I attended your lecture in Blackpool Labour Party conference with our leader, Neil Armstrong. Okay. The issue is about drinking water, I mean, recoverable drinking water from the ocean. You rightly mentioned about the overfishing in addition to the pollution and biological degradation of ocean. Even today, IHT wants your partner. I mean, of course, I don't know how you treat America as a rival or partner. IHT wants that American to come out with a roadmap for the ocean. So we, the third world citizen, of course, you rightly mentioned about the densely populated third world citizen, we are not as important as the Western audience here. So we also have a vision for the world, not only sustainable Europe, for a world. While we want you, the gas-guzzling Europeans, to drive hydrogen-powered vehicles, we also want you, the rich people, to give us more facilities so that we can have desalinating plant, because every mobile phone user in India for there are at least 10 children who can't even have drinking water. So why is that you all talk about bananas? Why is that you the human being? We are all human beings. Why don't, of course, we have kleptocrats, you people, give us bribes or anything. Why don't you, Europe is a new Europe, that you have moral responsibility for not only for your colonies, but for the whole third world. Why, rather than talking, let us do some deeds. Why don't we give us
let the
water?
Commissioner answer.
Yeah, let us have a healthy world. You know,
let the commissioner answer.
Well, if you speak more quickly than that, I will not be able to follow. But I think I understood that you. But today also, the European Union is the biggest donor in the world. But so of course this is an important part to act internationally, and we do. We do act also on the water issues and to make sure that we live up to our commitments from Johannesburg and from all these international or multilateral fora where we participate. So we try to do so, and we try to integrate better the environment into our donor schemes and when we work with the developing countries. And of course the whole multilateral approach is so important that we sit at the same table to have this overview. But I think also that the developing countries expect us to take the lead, to show that we can change our destructive way of consuming and producing to allow us to use the resources where they are better needed, because we also pollute. It's the same water. It's the same water that just, you know, in the eternal life cycle of water, we are all dependent on how we treat it as well and not to pollute it. So just to take the lead and to demonstrate that we are able to do
something. As soon as I go,
if I understand.
Sri Lanka, you can rebuild the water system there.
I've been working on Sri Lanka, as you know.
I'm not selfish, that is South India. Come to Sri Lanka.
You come from Sri Lanka?
Anna, we are a very sad last one.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, up the front, up the top, brother.
Yes, you mentioned earlier the
problem
of environmental subsidies, of agricultural subsidies to the environment. And I was wondering how you envision reconciling that with also the problem that we have with fossil fuels in terms of the model car that you presented. Is it better to have an environmentally friendly car made with GM or subsidized maize and soybeans, or to have petrol?
Well, probably. I mean, the bio the biofuels and the bio-based energy, I think, has a much bigger potential than the one we are exploring today. And I think we should use the full potential of biofuels. And of course, this is another renewable source of energy. So I think we should do so, while also thinking about solar energy or wind power and all the other sources of renewable energy. I think that you're absolutely right in pointing to the contradictory policies that we have with our common agricultural policy, which actually creates also many of the environmental problems that we then, with the other hand, have to sort of pay for or try to mitigate or help. And that is, of course, why it's so important to have a reform of the common agricultural policy. And we have taken the first prudent steps, but at least in the right direction, the decoupling of, you know, direct support to farmers to have more on the agri-environmental budget, etc., etc. But it's still not enough. That is also my, it's in many ways a perverse system that we have for agricultural subsidies, as you know. So this is an area where we have to continue to work. But as it is today, I would say, of course, if you could buy this soybean car, that would be fantastic. But the problem is that also in other motor or car fairs, it is not advertised as an advantage that it's an environmentally friendly car. Now it's security, and that is why they grow bigger and bigger. And they have these car psychologists that tell us that, yes, they exist as a profession, car psychologists, that tell the car manufacturers that they have to produce cars and design cars that look really scary. Sort of the monsters, because this is so important for our security to feel that we are safe in our cars, and especially in the US this is clearly seen, but also in Europe. So we have the same pattern of consumption. Again, we don't ask whether how much this emits and whether it's good for the environment. So there is still a lot more to do. As you know, we have a voluntary agreement with car manufacturers in Europe, in Japan and Korea. Where we have agreed on how much they should be allowed to emit, and that we have a slow decrease of emissions for CO2 from cars. And we are now renegotiating that, or rather checking on where we are and the new standards. And of course, they have a lot of complaining and whining to do with this really difficult. We have reached the technological limits and so on. So that's where it's good to show the soybean car, actually. And what if the Chinese produce the first hydrogen fuel cell-based car? Of course, again, we have to look at the future. What do we expect from a future market, from future consumers, from future big cities? Will they ask for more petrol-based products? Will we have room for bigger cars, or what will be the solutions of tomorrow? And those shipbuilders who actually built ships in, and I think some of them in Denmark, that with double hull tankers, they are now the winners, because after all these accidents, you know that the single hull tankers will be phased out. So they invested, they had some difficult times, they lived through that, and now they are the winners because they did sort of back costing instead of forecasting.
I know you've spoken and written passionately about biodiversity loss, and I know that the EU is I think committed to the goal of halting biodiversity loss by 2010, but it seems to me that and I wonder, how do you think that can be really brought to come to pass, and won't it need more than purely utilitarian, anthropocentric sort of eco-efficiency framed ways of thinking? Won't it require really a very different way of thinking about the environment and about other species, which rather goes beyond this sort of technical vision?
Yes, isn't my train leaving now? No, it's really one of the biggest challenges we have, to be able to reach this ambitious target of halting the decline of biodiversity by 2010. And of course, if you see how much of land and biodiversity we want to sort of use for building or road construction or what have you, this seems almost impossible. I think that we are struggling with establishing sort of the first face of all this, and that is to make sure that we have these lists of protected species and birds and the habitats that we need to ensure that we can protect for the future from all member states. And we have not yet the complete lists established, but at least we are seeing, we are making progress, and especially since we started to threaten member states by withholding the money for structural funds and other projects. If they did not give us a list, suddenly they started to come in. So I think that you need a combination of economic steering instruments and pressure and incentives, but also to create a better understanding. And of course, somebody will have to sort of give a voice to snails and all living creatures. And I try. We have to continue to make sure that we explain the whole, again, the whole ecosystem and how dependent we are on the ecosystem. But we need active policies in each member state, and they have to implement the current legislation. If not, we will take them to court.
Yes, I'd like to go back to one of the last points you mentioned, and namely the quality of life issue, which I agree with you is like crucial, underlying probably everything you said. And in particular, I'd like to draw the attention to policy matters with regard to the urban environment in Europe and in the framework of the communication of toward an urban environment thematic strategy. Within this strategy, it has been suggested that cities should adopt environmental management plans. And I was wondering what your opinion, what your view is regarding the integration of all three dimensions of sustainability rather than merely the environmental one. What your opinion would be on whether these plans should be adopted on a voluntary or on a compulsory basis, and where resources would come from. And finally, whether you think that there is any scope for pre-existing tools such as the European Common Indicators to be still used in this framework, or what do you envisage could be?
The European Common Indicators. Yeah.
That's also a difficult issue, because you see the whole urban environment, you seem very well informed. You know that this is a conflict that is going on. Should we make these plans, the management plans and all of that, the planning instrument, should we make it a mandatory provision or should it be sort of voluntary? This is a difficult fight, because this is still an area where member states refer to subsidiarity. Why should Brussels intervene to tell us how we should plan our urban environment? This is truly something that should be done at nation level, and where Brussels should not intervene. Even if they see the advantages of coordinating, working together, creating networks of sustainable cities and all of that. But we are still in a phase where this is sort of in contrast to very much of subsidiarity. So I don't think we can go too quickly, move too quickly forward on making these provisions into mandatory or legislation or what have you. I think we will have to move step by step. And again, we have limited competence in this area. This is still very much for member states to do. And sometimes we simply have to accept that, but try to do the best we can out of this situation, help them rather than force them.
My name's Andy Goulton. I'm a member of the LSE's Environment Centre. The UK government's recently tabled a range of amendments to the European Constitution. I wondered, what changes would you like to see made to strengthen the role of the environment within that constitution?
I would like to see a protocol added on sustainable development to the new constitutional treaty. I proposed such a protocol. I have developed a text for such a protocol. I think it. We will see. I mean, I think the Irish presidency don't want too many open questions, and probably they think that you can have a protocol or you can be without it, because the texts already in the treaty are good enough. But the advantage of having a protocol is that you could elaborate on the definition. You could also point out the implementation methods, and you could say what happens if you don't implement it. And that's the whole idea of the protocol. You have it on subsidiarity, proportionality, etc. You could have it on sustainable development. I think that we need qualified majority voting instead of unanimity on, for example, economic instruments, taxation for the environment. I hope that this could be changed as well. I hope we can continue to use the community method. And that is really my main concern, that in the new treaty we preserve the community method, the way we take decisions involving stakeholders, consulting stakeholders in an open and transparent way and with the given roles for the different institutions.
Just one quick question. Just wondering what, if anything, the EU is doing to step up encouraging Russia to ratify the Kyoto Protocol now that we're coming down to the wire of 2005?
Two weeks ago, we went seven commissioners to meet with President Putin and Fradkov, the new prime minister in Russia, and a number of our interlocutors or our collaborators, other ministers as well. We sat for I think almost 2 hours with Putin to discuss, among other things, the Kyoto Protocol. We are trying to make it a part of the bigger political picture, that this is important to Europe, and Russia need to cooperate with Europe and the European Union. I was trying to give our best arguments why the European Union has ratified the Kyoto Protocol and why we think it would be good also for Russia to do so. I understand from his reply that he knows this file very well, that he also sees it as an additional burden on their industry, and that is their problem. The period that will come under the Kyoto Protocol from 2012 and on will of course mean that their industry will have to modernize, that they will have to get emissions, greenhouse gas emissions down, and they are afraid of what that, the constraint that will put on their economic development and whether they can live up to that. They have not said no. They are still calculating what this could mean to the Russian economy. They will look at it from a purely Russian angle, and I hope that they will I think they will ratify in the end, but they will make the most out of it, the fact that they hold the key to entry into force of the protocol.
I was just wondering, given the importance of governance and civil involvement and local level in the sustainable development agenda, what you say to criticisms that the EU, being even more far removed from the local level, with most people not even knowing who their EU representative is, what do you say to that criticism? What's your argument to that?
Well, all of this is meaningful only if people also act at the local level. I see more and more happening at the local and regional level, which is really exciting and encouraging. And I think we have to communicate better. And I think this is really where we have a big problem at the Commission level and at the European Union level, that we are so bad at communicating what we do and what we want to achieve for the future, our overall objectives and targets and the work that we're doing. But I'm also encouraged by all the local Agenda 21 groups, for example, that are trying to follow up and apply sustainable development at the local level. So I think we can only give the record what we have delivered and what we're working on, and encourage also people at the local level to work for it.
In view of what you said about the need to reduce harmful subsidies.
Hold it a bit closer.
In view of what you said about the need to remove harmful subsidies and to recalibrate taxes, what can and should be done by the enlarged EU to deal with the situation where aircraft fuel remains untaxed? At least, what can be done within Europe?
Yeah. Well, we can, of course, lead the way, even though we would prefer an international solution. And we've said we should try first through the international fora to have an international taxation also on aircraft fuel. But if it is not possible, if we see that road is closed, we are willing to take an initiative at the European Union level.
And that is our overall objective, or the general objective. And I think that, you know, it's clear that there are too many subsidies and subsidies for coal or fossil fuels, and it is not sort of integrated or not being made visible to consumers. So I think that this is also part of it, to make that clear to consumers what these subsidies are. But of course, member states are not happy always about this, and the taxation is a national issue. But at least try to move things forward.
Peter Jones from Biffa Severn Trent. We're a waste and water company. I was really wanting to pick up from that last point. On our calculations, the shift to a much more resource-efficient UK economy is relatively small, probably an annual cost of 3-4% on GDP. Would you agree with the proposition that we're, at the moment, we're stuck in something of a blind alley of subsidies and regulatory threats through directives, whereas in fact we ought to be somehow developing a much more proactive discussion with a relatively small number of supply chains in food, electronics, electricals, chemicals, of course, and the EU could be doing a lot more in dialogue with financial institutions to then translate those mechanisms through tradable permits, so having, if you like, internalized private sector pricing systems that act like taxes on the resource inefficient.
We are starting to use also market-based instruments like trading, as you know, emissions trading now for Europe. And of course, I see what you mean of sort of the local distribution and local nets, which are necessary at the same time as our economies are more and more global. And the market is truly global. So you will have to have a combination of the both. And I hope that the national strategies for sustainable development will look at that as well, to be more resource effective. And I think you in a way, you need both and to connect to also the bigger global market. So if you try to do too much at the local level, then the companies will also complain, because in most cases, they are active in the whole world or all over Europe. So they say the by the same rules, and a level playing field is so important to them. But I think I agree in general with what you're saying, and we should look at it also in all the sustainable development strategies on how to create the right systems with the right incentives.
Back up to this corner. Seems to have a lot of questions. I was going to come back to you next.
I was wondering, ma'am, that you said that there's a psychological need amongst consumers for having bigger cars because it gives them a feeling of safety. Another thing you said, the time for sustainable development has come. Ma'am, we live in a world which is highly volatile as far as wars, civil strife, everything which is going on around us. How far do you think the definition of sustainable development, according to you, actually influences how does this where there is no peace in the world, and how does sustainable development, where you're actually wanting everybody to be able to utilize just as much as will provide a sustainable future for everybody to come, when you're not even sure whether they're going to live for another 10 years or not, how do the two things match together?
I think that's why this concept of sustainable development that has been constantly attacked for being fluffy or encompassing everything or being difficult to interpret and translate into action, why this beaten concept has survived, that it carries some kind of magic. We understand that in the end we will have to look at the social aspect, how that it all depends on people, and also the involvement of people, democracy and governance and peace of all these elements in the social leg, as well as the economy. We need to create jobs, we need sound economic systems, and it can only be based on taking good care of the environment, using natural resources and the nature around us in the right way, that this carries some kind of magic that has kept this strange concept of sustainable development alive. So I think that is also what is fascinating with it, that it offers that holistic approach and says that it has to do with all the three elements to create a future which is sustainable. You cannot neglect the one for the other, but you have to look at it in as a whole. And I think that the democratic aspect of this and the people aspect of it is so important that all decisions we take in the future should be looked at, how they influence people and the planet and the money.
Commissioner has a trained cat, so I'm going to take just two more questions. One down here.
I'd like to return to the subject.
Can you use the mic, because it's difficult to hear?
Thank you.
Just hold it to your speak.
Can I return to the subject first raised by the first question this evening about population growth, which is running at 80 million a year worldwide? That's the equivalent of the size of Germany being added every year. When is the European Union, particularly your directorate, going to formulate a sustainable, environmentally sustainable population policy, and how can you influence the rest of the world to join in that effort?
Well, you raise very difficult and challenging questions. This is, of course, something that we have to do together with the people in DG Development and look at, for example, the land strategies and our overall development policies and better integrate, of course, environment into this. And the whole population issue is an important one. In the end, of course, it has to do with education. If you educate people, if you educate women, they will also have fewer children. And if you have a chance to, as I learned from talking to women in South Africa when I was at the meeting in Johannesburg, they described to me the effect of actually having a well drilled in that village. So close to they had to go to walk to the Limpopo River every day. When they had this well, they could stay in the village. They could do better cleaning. They could cook better, and time was left for them to develop their village. So it has to be integrated and looked at in that bigger context. That also population issues are an important aspect has to do with poverty, and water also has to do with poverty. So I think it's you cannot have only a population policy, but rather look at it as fighting poverty. Well, a lot of things are not working, and of course we have to make sure that we improve it. And I think this also again has to do with governance and how this money are spent, or if it is done in a way so it is designed to help that particular country. I don't think we can say that we have succeeded the way Africa develops or other parts of the world either. But we have to continue to try and do our best. And of course, this is an element, the environment is a very important element in development policy.
And the last question, I think, is going to go to the LSE Student Union Environment Officer to prove we have one.
I'd just like to come back to what you were saying earlier about the need to act locally as well as on a European and a global level. Would you support things like LSE University conducting a good environmental review and developing a really powerful environmental policy? And if so, would you encourage the audience here to go and sign one of these Go Green postcards on the stall outside?
The answer yes.
Yes. Of course, I support all of that campaign that you could see outside.
There is indeed a desk outside the door on the right here with these green cards for signing and what have you. I don't know what I'm encouraging.
People also feel that. I'm very cautious not to be too moralistic. I think this is the risk of being an environment commissioner. You could of course be the one who cries wolf all the time until nobody listens and. So I think that not to be too moralistic and not to be among the doomsday mongers, but I think that most people really would like to make a difference or to do the right things, if only they knew what that means and if they could help. So I think that is they offer an opportunity to help to do the right things.
I think the Commissioner this evening has not only enlightened and inspired us, but has thrown us down a challenge. And I think for that we should thank her very much indeed. Thanks very much.
Thank you.